supposed freedom of the future. End of footnote. The first to realize this was Kurt Gödel, the great 20th century logician who was Einstein's last friend, accompanying him on walks along the streets of Princeton. Near to a black hole, the lines converge towards it. This is because the mass of the black hole slows time to such a degree that at its border, called the horizon, time stands still. So, in order to exit from a black hole, you would need to move towards the present rather than towards the future. This is impossible. Objects can only move towards the future. This is what constitutes a black hole, an inclination of the light cones towards the interior, marking a horizon, closing off a region of space in the future from everything that surrounds it. It is nothing other than this. It is the curious local structure of the present that produces black holes. More than 100 years have passed since we learned that the present of the universe does not exist, and yet this continues to confound us and still seems difficult to conceptualize. Every so often a physicist mutinies and tries to show that it isn't true. Philosophers continue to discuss the disappearance of the present. Today there are often conferences devoted to the subject. If the present has no meaning, then what exists in the universe? Is not what exists precisely what is here in the present? The whole idea that the universe exists now in a certain configuration and changes together with the passage of time simply doesn't stack up anymore. Chapter 4. Loss of Independence. And on that wave we will all have to navigate, all who are nourished by the fruits of the earth. Book 2, Ode 14. What happens when nothing happens? It only takes a few micrograms of LSD to expand our experience of time onto an epic and magical scale. How long is forever? Asks Alice. Sometimes just 1 second, replies the white rabbit. There are dreams lasting an instant in which everything seems frozen for an eternity. Time is elastic in our personal experience of it. Hours fly by like minutes, and minutes are oppressively slow, as if they were centuries. On the one hand, time is structured by the liturgical calendar. Easter follows Lent, and Lent is followed by Christmas. Ramadan opens with Halal and closes with Eid al-Fitr. On the other, every mystical experience, such as the sacred moment in which the host is consecrated, throws the faithful outside of time, putting them in touch with eternity. Before Einstein told us that it wasn't true, how the devil did we get into our heads that time passes everywhere at the same speed? It was certainly not our direct experience of the passage of time that gave us the idea that time elapses at the same rate, always and everywhere. So where did we get it from? For centuries, we have divided time into days. The word time derives from an Indo-European root, di or dai, meaning to divide. For centuries, we have divided the days into hours. For most of those centuries, however, hours were longer in the summer and shorter in the winter because the 12 hours divided the time between dawn and sunset. The first hour was dawn and the 12th hour was sunset, regardless of the season, as we read in the parable of the wine grower in the Gospel according to Matthew. Since, as we say nowadays, during summer, more time passes between dawn and sunset than during the winter, in the summer, the hours were longer and the hours were shorter in wintertime. Sundials, hourglasses, and water clocks already existed in the ancient world in the Mediterranean region and in China, but they did not play the cruel role that clocks have today in the organization of our lives. It's only in the 14th century in Europe that people's lives start to be regulated by mechanical clocks. Cities and villages build their churches, erect bell towers next to them, and place a clock on the bell tower to mark the rhythm of collective activities. The era of clock-regulated time begins. Gradually, time slips from the hands of the angels and into those of the mathematicians, as is graphically illustrated at Strasbourg Cathedral, where two sundials are surmounted respectively by an angel, one inspired by earlier sundials from 1200, and by a mathematician on the sundial put there in 1400. The usefulness of clocks supposedly resides in the fact that they tell the same time. And yet this idea is also more modern than we might imagine. For centuries, as long as travel was on horseback, on foot, or in carriages, there was no reason to synchronize clocks between one place and another. There was good reason for not doing so. Midday is, by definition, when the sun is at its highest. Every city and village had a sundial that registered the moment the sun was at its midpoint, allowing the clock on the bell tower to be regulated with it for all to see. But the sun does not reach midday at the same moment in Lecce as it does in Venice or in Florence or Turin, because the sun moves from east to west. Midday arrives first in Venice and significantly later in Turin. And for centuries, the clocks in Venice were a good half hour ahead of those in Turin. Every small village had its own peculiar hour. A train station in Paris kept its own hour, a little behind the rest of the city, as a kind of courtesy towards travellers who were running late. In the 19th century, the telegraph arrives. Trains become commonplace and fast, and the problem arises of properly synchronizing clocks between one city and another. It is awkward to organize train timetables if each station marks time differently. It is in the United States that the first attempt is made to standardize time. Initially, it's proposed to fix a universal hour for the entire world, to call, for instance, 12 o'clock the moment at which it is midday in London, so that midday would fall at 12 o'clock in London and around 6 o'clock in New York. The proposal is not well received because people are attached to local time. In 1883, a compromise is reached with the idea of dividing the world into time zones, thereby standardizing time only within each zone. In this way, the discrepancy between 12 on the clock and local midday is limited to a maximum of about 30 minutes. The proposal is gradually accepted by the rest of the world, and clocks begin to be synchronized between different cities. It can hardly be pure coincidence that before gaining a university position, the young Einstein worked in the Swiss Patent Office dealing specifically with patents relating to the synchronization of clocks at railway stations. It was probably there that it dawned on him. The problem of synchronizing clocks was ultimately an insoluble one. In other words, only a few years passed between the moment at which we agreed to synchronize clocks and the moment at which Einstein realized that it was impossible to do so exactly. For millennia before clocks, our only regular way of measuring time had been the alternation of day and night. The rhythm of day followed by night also regulates the lives of plants and animals. Diurnal rhythms are ubiquitous in the natural world. They are essential to life, and it seems to me probable that they played a key role in the very origin of life on Earth, since an oscillation is required to set a mechanism in motion. Living organisms are full of clocks of various kinds, molecular, neuronal, chemical, hormonal, each of them more or less in tune with the others. There are chemical mechanisms that keep to a 24-hour rhythm even in the biochemistry of single cells. The diurnal rhythm is an elementary source of our idea of time. Night follows day, day follows night. We count the beats of this great clock, we count the days. In the ancient consciousness of humanity, time is, above all, this counting of days. As well as the days, we then count the years, and the seasons, the cycles of the moon, the swings of a pendulum, the number of times that an hourglass is turned. This is the way in which we have traditionally conceived of time, counting the ways in which things change. Aristotle is the first we are aware of to have asked himself the question, what is time? And he came to the following conclusion. Time is the measurement of change. Things change continually. We call time the measurement, the counting of this change. Aristotle's idea is sound. Time is what we refer to when we ask when. After how much time will you return means when will you return. The answer to the question when refers to something that happens. I'll return in 3 days' time means that between departure and return, the sun will have completed 3 circuits in the sky. It's as simple as that. So if nothing changes, if nothing moves, does time therefore cease to pass? Aristotle believed that it did. If nothing changes, time does not pass, because time is our way of situating ourselves in relation to the changing of things. The placing of ourselves in relation to the counting of days. Time is the measure of change. If nothing changes, there is no time. But what then is the time that I hear coursing in the silence? If it is dark and our bodily experience is nil, Aristotle writes in his Physics, but some change is happening within the mind, we immediately suppose that some time has passed as well. In other words, even the time that we perceive flowing within us is the measure of a movement that is internal. If nothing moves, there is no time, because time is nothing but the registering of movement. Newton instead assumes the exact opposite. In his magnum opus, The Principia, he writes, I do not define time, space, place, and motion as being well known to all. Only I must observe that the common people conceive those quantities under no other notions but from the relation they bear to sensible objects, and thence arise certain prejudices, for the removing of which it will be convenient to distinguish them into absolute and relative, true and apparent, mathematical and common. In other words, Newton recognizes that a kind of time exists that measures days and movements, the one treated by Aristotle, relative, apparent, and common. But he also contends that in addition to this, another time must exist, true time, that passes regardless, independently of things and of their changes. If all things remained motionless and even the movements of our souls were to be frozen, this time would continue to pass, according to Newton, unaffected and equal to itself. True time. It's the exact opposite of what Aristotle writes. True time, says Newton, is not directly accessible, only indirectly through calculation. It is not the same as that given by days, because the natural days are truly unequal, though they are commonly considered as equal and used for a measure of time. Astronomers correct this inequality that they may measure the celestial motions by a more accurate time. So, who is right? Aristotle or Newton? Two of the most acute and profound investigators of nature that the world has ever seen are proposing two opposite ways of thinking about time. Two giants are pulling us in opposite directions. Time is only a way of measuring how things change, as Aristotle would have it, or should we be thinking that an absolute time exists that flows by itself independently of things? The question we should really be asking is this. Which of these two ways of thinking about time helps us to understand the world better? Which of the two conceptual schemes is more efficient? For a few centuries, reason seemed to come down on the side of Newton. Newton's model, based on the idea of time independent of things, has enabled the construction of modern physics, a physics that works incredibly well. And it assumes that time exists as an entity that runs in a way which is uniform and imperturbable. Newton writes equations containing the letter T for time, which describes how things move in time. What does this letter mean? Does T indicate time shaped by the longer hours of summer and the shorter ones of winter? Obviously not. It indicates time that is absolute, true, and mathematical, assumed by Newton to run independently of things that change or things that move. Clocks, for Newton, are devices that seek, albeit in a manner that is always imprecise, to follow this equal and uniform flowing of time. Newton writes that this absolute, true, and mathematical time is not perceptible. It must be deduced through calculation and observation from the regularity of phenomena. Newton's time is not the evidence given to us by our senses. It is an elegant intellectual construction. If, my dear cultivated reader, the existence of this Newtonian concept of time, which is independent of things, seems to you simple and natural, it's because you encountered it at school. Because it has gradually become the way in which we all think about time. It has filtered through school textbooks throughout the world and ended up becoming our common way of understanding time. We have turned it into our common sense. But the existence of a time that is uniform, independent of things and of their movement, which today seems so natural to us, is not an ancient intuition that is natural to humanity itself. It's an idea of Newton's. The majority of philosophers have in fact responded negatively to this idea. In a still celebrated furious counterblast, Leibniz defended the traditional thesis according to which time is only the order of events, arguing that there is no such thing as an autonomous time. Legend has it that Leibniz, whose name is still occasionally spelled with a T, Leibniz, had deliberately dropped the letter from his name in accordance with his belief in the non-existence of time, T. Before Newton, time for humanity was the way of counting how things changed. Before him, no one had thought it possible that a time independent of things could exist. Don't take your intuitions and ideas to be natural. They are often the products of the ideas of audacious thinkers who came before us. But of these two giants, Aristotle and Newton, was it really Newton who was right? What exactly is this time that he introduced, managing to convince the entire world that it exists? One that works so brilliantly well in his equations and yet is not the time that we perceive. To get out from between these two giants and, in a strange way, to reconcile them, a third was needed. Before getting to him, however, a brief digression on space is in order. What is there where there is nothing? The two interpretations of time, the measure of when with regard to events, as Aristotle wanted, the entity that runs even when nothing happens, according to Newton, can be repeated for space. Time is what we speak of when we ask when. Space is what we speak of when we ask where. If I ask, where is the Colosseum? One possible answer is, it's in Rome. If I ask, where are you? A possible answer might be, at home. To reply to the question, where is something, means to indicate something else that is around that thing. If I say, in the Sahara, you will visualize me surrounded by sand dunes. Aristotle was the first to discuss in depth and with acuity the meaning of space or place, and to arrive at a precise definition. The place of a thing is what surrounds that thing. As in the case of time, Newton suggests that we should think differently. The space defined by Aristotle, the enumeration of what surrounds each thing, is called relative, apparent, and common by Newton. He calls absolute, true, and mathematical space in itself, which exists even where there is nothing. The difference between Aristotle and Newton is glaring. For Newton, between two things, there may also be empty space. For Aristotle, it is absurd to speak of empty space because space is only the spatial order of things. If there are no things, their extension, their contacts, there is no space. Newton imagines that things are situated in a space that continues to exist, empty even when divested of things. For Aristotle, this empty space is nonsensical because if two things do not touch, it means that there is something else between them, and if there is something, then this something is a thing, and therefore a thing that is there. It cannot be that there is nothing. For my part, I find it curious that both these ways of thinking about space originate from our everyday experience. The difference between them exists due to a quirky accident of the world in which we live. The lightness of air, the presence of which we only barely perceive. We can say, I see a table, a chair, a pen, the ceiling, and that between myself and the table there is nothing. Or we can say that between one and another of these things there is air. Sometimes we speak of air as if it were something, sometimes as if it were nothing. Sometimes as if it were there, sometimes as if it were not there. We're used to saying this glass is empty in order to say that it is full of air. We can consequently think of the world around us as almost empty, with just a few objects here and there, or alternatively as completely full of air. In the end, Aristotle and Newton do not engage in profound metaphysics. They are only using these two different intuitive and ingenious ways of seeing the world around us, taking or not taking air into account, and transforming them into definitions of space. Aristotle, always top of the class, wants to be precise. He does not say that the glass is empty, he says that it is full of air. And he remarks that, in our experience, there is never a place where there is nothing, not even air. Newton, looking not so much for accuracy as for efficiency of the conceptual paradigm that needs to be constructed in order to describe the movement of things, thinks not about air, but about objects. Air, after all, seems to have little effect on a falling stone. We can imagine that it is not even there. As in the case of time, Newton's container space may seem natural to us, but it is a recent idea that has spread due to the enormous influence of his thought. That which seems intuitive to us now is the result of scientific and philosophical elaborations in the past. The Newtonian idea of empty space seems to be confirmed when Torricelli demonstrates that it is possible to remove the air from a bottle. It soon becomes clear, however, that inside the bottle many physical entities remain, electric and magnetic fields and a constant swarming of quantum particles. The existence of a complete void without any physical entity except amorphous space, absolute, true, and mathematical, remains a brilliant theoretical idea introduced by Newton to found his physics on. For there is no scientific experimental evidence to support its existence. An ingenious hypothesis, perhaps the most profound insight achieved by one of the greatest scientists, but is it one that actually corresponds to the reality of things? Does Newton's space really exist? If it exists, is it really amorphous? Can a place exist where nothing exists? The question is identical to the analogous one regarding time. Does Newton's absolute, true, and mathematical time exist, flowing when nothing happens? If it exists, is it something altogether different from the things of this world? Is it so very independent from them? The answer to all these questions lies in an unexpected synthesis of the apparently contradictory ideas held by these two giants. And to accomplish this, it was necessary for a third giant to enter the dance. Footnote. I have been criticized for telling the history of science as if it were just the result of the ideas of a few brilliant minds, rather than the painstaking work of generations. It's a fair enough criticism, and I apologize to the generations who have done and are doing the necessary work. My only excuse is that I am not attempting a detailed historical analysis or scientific methodology. I'm only synthesizing a few crucial steps, slow technical, cultural, and artistic advances made by innumerable workshops of painters and artisans when necessary before the Sistine Chapel was possible. But in the end, it was Michelangelo who painted it. End of footnote. The Dance of the Three Giants. The synthesis between Aristotle's time and Newton's is the most valuable achievement made by Einstein. It is the crowning jewel of his thought. The answer is that the time and space Newton had intuited the existence of, beyond tangible matter, do effectively exist. They are real. Time and space are real phenomena. But they are in no way absolute. They are not at all independent from what happens. They are not in any way different from the other substances of the world as Newton had imagined them to be. We can think of a great Newtonian canvas on which the story of the world is drawn, but this canvas is made of the same stuff that everything else in the world is made of, the same substance that constitutes stone, light, and air. It is made of fields. Physicists call fields the substances which, to the best of our knowledge, constitute the weave of the physical reality of the world. Sometimes they may be given exotic names. Dirac fields are the fabric of which tables and stars are made. The electromagnetic field is the weave of which light is made, as well as the origin of the forces that make electric motors turn and the needle of a compass point north. But, here is the key point, there is also a gravitational field. It is the origin of the force of gravity, but it is also the texture that forms Newton's space and time, the fabric on which the rest of the world is drawn. Clocks are mechanisms that measure its extension. The meters used for measuring length are portions of matter which measure another aspect of its extension. Space-time is the gravitational field, and vice versa. It is something that exists by itself, as Newton intuited, even without matter, but it is not an entity that is different from the other things in the world, as Newton believed. It is a field like the others. More than a drawing on a canvas, the world is like a superimposition of canvases, of strata, where the gravitational field is only one among others. Just like the others, it is neither absolute nor uniform, nor is it fixed. It flexes, stretches, and jostles with the others, pushing and pulling against them. Equations describe the reciprocal influences that all the fields have on each other, and space-time is one of these fields. Footnote. The route by which Einstein arrived at this conclusion was a long one. It didn't end with the writing of the equations of the field in 1915, but continued in torturous efforts to understand its physical significance, causing him in the process to change his ideas repeatedly. He was confused in particular regarding the existence of solutions without matter, and by whether gravitational waves were real or not. He achieves definitive clarity only in his last writings, and in particular in the fifth appendix, Relativity and the Problem of Space, which was added to the fifth edition of Relativity, the Special and General Theory, Methuen, London, 1954. This appendix can be read at http://www.relativitybook.com/resources/Einstein_space.html. For copyright reasons, this appendix is not included in most editions of the book. A more in-depth discussion can be found in Chapter 2 of My Quantum Gravity, Cambridge University Press, Cambridge, 2004. End of footnote. The gravitational field can also be smooth and flat like a straight surface, and this is the version that Newton described. If we measure it in meters, we discover that the Euclidean geometry that we learn at school applies. But the field can also undulate in what we call gravitational waves. It can contract and expand. Remember the clocks in Chapter 1 that slow down in the vicinity of a mass? They slow down because there is, in a precise sense, less gravitational field there. There is less time there. The canvas formed by the gravitational field is like a vast elastic sheet that can be pulled and stretched. Its stretching and bending is the origin of the force of gravity, of things falling, and provides a better explanation of this than the old Newtonian theory of gravity. Imagine a diagram showing, as we discovered earlier, more time passes above than below. Now imagine that the diagram is elastic. Imagine stretching it so that the time in the mountains actually becomes elongated, that the vertical axis becomes wider the higher it gets. Now, the longer time in the mountains effectively corresponds to a greater length of time. This image illustrates what physicists call curved space-time. Curved because it is distorted. Distances are stretched and contracted just like the elastic sheet when it is pulled. This is why the light cones were inclined, as mentioned in Chapter 3. Time thus becomes part of a complicated geometry, woven together with the geometry of space. This is the synthesis that Einstein found between Aristotle's conception of time and Newton's. With a tremendous beat of his wings, Einstein understood that Aristotle and Newton are both right. Newton is right in intuiting that something else exists in addition to the simple things that we see moving and changing. True and mathematical Newtonian time exists. It is a real entity. It is the gravitational field, the elastic sheet, the curved space-time in the diagram. But Newton is wrong in assuming that this time is independent from things, and that it passes regularly, imperturbably, separately from everything else. For his part, Aristotle is right to say that when and where are always located in relation to something. But this something can also be just the field, the spatio-temporal entity of Einstein, because this is a dynamic and concrete entity, like all those in reference to which, as Aristotle rightly observed, we are capable of locating ourselves. All this is perfectly coherent, and Einstein's equations describing the distortions of the gravitational field and its effects on clocks and meters have been repeatedly verified for more than a century. But our idea of time has lost another of its constituent parts, its supposed independence from the rest of the world. The three-handed dance of these intellectual giants, Aristotle, Newton, and Einstein, has guided us to a deeper understanding of time and of space. There is a structure of reality that is the gravitational field. It is not separate from the rest of physics, nor is it the stage across which the world passes. It is a dynamic component of the great dance of the world, similar to all the others, interacting with the others, determining the rhythm of those things that we call meters and clocks, and the rhythm of all physical phenomena. Success, as ever, is destined to be short-lived. Even great success. Einstein writes the equations of the gravitational field in 1915, and barely a year later, it is Einstein himself who observes that this cannot be the last word on the nature of time and space because of the existence of quantum mechanics. The gravitational field, like all physical things, must necessarily have quantum properties. Chapter 5. Quanta of Time. There's an amphora of old wine in the house of 9 years vintage. There is in the garden, Phyllis, celery for braiding crowns and much ivy. I invite you to celebrate this day in mid-April, a festive one for me, dearer than my own birthday. Book 4, Ode 11. The strange landscape of the physics of relativity that I have described so far becomes even more alien when we consider quanta and the quantum properties of space and of time. The discipline which studies these is called quantum gravity, and this is my own field of research. There is not yet a theory of quantum gravity that has been generally accepted by the scientific community or obtained experimental support. My scientific life has been largely dedicated to contributing to the construction of a possible solution to the problem. Loop quantum gravity, or loop theory. Not everyone is betting on this turning out to be the right solution. Friends who work on string theory, for instance, are following different paths, and the battle to establish who is right is still raging. This is good. Science also grows thanks to fierce debates. Sooner or later, it will become clear which theory is correct, and perhaps we will not have long to wait. Divergences of opinion regarding the nature of time, however, have diminished in the last few years, and many conclusions have become reasonably clear to most. What has been clarified is that the residual temporal scaffolding of general relativity illustrated in the previous chapter also falls away if we take quanta into account. Universal time is shattered into a myriad of proper times, but if we factor in the quanta, we must accept the idea that each of these times, in turn, fluctuates and is dispersed as in a cloud, and can have only certain values and not others. They can no longer manage to form the spatio-temporal sheet outlined in the previous chapters. The three fundamental discoveries that quantum mechanics has led to are these: granularity, indeterminacy, and the relational aspect of physical variables. Each one of these demolishes further the little that was left of our idea of time. Let's consider them one by one. Granularity. The time measured by a clock is quantified. That is to say, it acquires only certain values and not others. It is as if time were granular rather than continuous. Granularity is the most characteristic feature of quantum mechanics, which takes its name from this. Quanta are elementary grains. A minimum scale exists for all phenomena. For the gravitational field, this is called the Planck scale. Minimum time is called Planck time. Its value can be easily estimated by combining the constants that characterize phenomena subject to relativity, gravity, and quantum mechanics. Together, these determine the time to 10 to the minus 44 seconds, 100 millionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second. This is Planck time. At this extremely minuscule level, quantum effects on time become manifest. Planck's time is small, much smaller than any actual clock is today capable of measuring. It is so extremely small that we should not be astounded to discover that down there, at such a minute scale, the notion of time is no longer valid. Why should it be? Nothing is valid always and everywhere. Sooner or later, we always come across something that is new. The quantization of time implies that almost all values of time t do not exist. If we could measure the duration of an interval with the most precise clock imaginable, we should find that the time measured takes only certain discrete special values. It is not possible to think of duration as continuous. We must think of it as discontinuous, not as something which flows uniformly, but as something which, in a certain sense, jumps kangaroo-like from one value to another. In other words, a minimum interval of time exists. Below this, the notion of time does not exist, even in its most basic meaning. Perhaps the rivers of ink which have been expended discussing the nature of the continuous over the centuries, from Aristotle to Heidegger, have been wasted. Continuity is only a mathematical technique for approximating very finely grained things. The world is subtly discrete, not continuous. The good Lord has not drawn the world with continuous lines. With a light hand, he has sketched it in dots, like surah. Granularity is ubiquitous in nature. Light is made of photons, the particles of light. The energy of electrons in atoms can acquire only certain values and not others. The purest air is granular, and so too is the densest matter. Once it is understood that Newton's space and time are physical entities like all others, it is natural to suppose that they are also granular. Theory confirms this idea. Loop quantum gravity predicts that elementary temporal leaps are small but finite. The idea that time could be granular, that there could be minimal intervals of time, is not new. It is defended in the 7th century by Isidore of Seville, his Etymologiae, and in the following century by the Venerable Bede, in a work suggestively entitled De Divisionibus Temporum, on the divisions of time. In the 13th century, the great philosopher Maimonides writes, "Time is composed of atoms, that is to say, of many parts that cannot be further subdivided on account of their short duration." The idea probably dates back even further. The loss of the original texts of Democritus prevents us from knowing whether it was already present in classical Greek atomism. Abstract thought can anticipate by centuries hypotheses that find a use or confirmation in scientific inquiry. The spatial sister of Planck time is Planck length, the minimum limit below which the notion of length becomes meaningless. Planck length is around 10 to the minus 33 centimeters, a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a millimeter. As a young man at university, I fell in love with the problem of what happens at this extremely small scale. I painted a large sheet with at its center in red, a glittering 10 to the minus 33. I hung it up in my bedroom in Bologna and decided that my goal would be to try to understand what happens down there, at the very tiny scale where time and space cease to be what they are, all the way to the elementary quanta of space and time. Then I spent the rest of my life actually trying to achieve this. Quantum superpositions of times. The second discovery made by quantum mechanics is indeterminacy. it is not possible to predict exactly, for instance, where an electron will appear tomorrow. Between one appearance and another, the electron has no precise position, as if it were dispersed in a cloud of probability. In the jargon of physicists, we say that this is in a superposition of positions. Space-time is a physical object like an electron. It too fluctuates. It too can be in a superposition of different configurations. The illustration of stretch time at the end of chapter 4, for example, if we take quantum mechanics into account, should be imagined as a blurred superposition of different spacetimes. As if several such diagrams drawn on tracing paper were placed on top of each other. Similarly, the structure of light cones fluctuates at all points that distinguish between past, present, and future. Even the distinction between present, past, and future thus becomes fluctuating, indeterminate. Just as a particle may be diffused in space, so too the differences between past and future may fluctuate. An event may be both before and after another one. Relations. Fluctuation does not mean that what happens is never determined. It means that it is determined only at certain moments and in an unpredictable way. Indeterminacy is resolved when a quantity interacts with something else. Footnote. The technical term for interaction used in this context, measure, is misleading, because it seems to imply that in order to create reality, we need an experimental physicist in a white coat. End of footnote. In the interaction, an electron materializes at a certain point. For example, it collides with a screen, is captured by a particle detector, or collides with a photon, thus acquiring a concrete position. But there is a strange aspect to this materialization of the electron. The electron is concrete only in relation to the other physical objects it is interacting with. With regards to all the others, the effect of the interaction is only to spread the contagion of indeterminacy. Concreteness occurs only in relation to a physical system. This, I believe, is the most radical discovery made by quantum mechanics. Footnote. I'm making use here of the relational interpretation of quantum mechanics, which is the one I myself find least implausible. The observations which follow, in particular the loss of the classical space-time satisfying Einstein's equations, remain invalid in every other interpretation that I know of. End of footnote. When an electron collides with an object, the screen of an old television set with a cathode tube, for example, the cloud of probability with which we conceived of it collapses, and the electron materializes at a point on the screen, producing one of the luminous dots that go into the making of a TV image. But it is only in relation to the screen that this happens. In relation to another object, the electron and screen are now together in a superposition of configurations. And it is only at the moment of further interaction with a third object that their shared cloud of probability collapses and materializes in a particular configuration, and so on. It is hard to take in the idea that an electron behaves in such a bizarre way. It's even more difficult to digest that this is also the way time and space behave. And yet, according to all the evidence, this is the way the quantum world works, the world which we inhabit. The physical substratum that determines duration and physical intervals, the gravitational field, does not only have a dynamic influenced by masses, it is also a quantum entity that does not have determined values until it interacts with something else. When it does, the durations are granular and determinate only for that something with which it interacts. They remain indeterminate for the rest of the universe. Time has loosened into a network of relations that no longer holds together as a coherent canvas. The picture of space-times, in the plural, fluctuating, superimposed one above the other, materializing at certain times with respect to particular objects, provides us with a very vague vision. But it is the best that we have for the fine granularity of the world. We are peering into the world of quantum gravity. Let me reprise the long dive into the depths made in the first part of this book. There is no single time. There is a different duration for every trajectory, and time passes at different rhythms according to place and according to speed. It is not directional. The difference between past and future does not exist in the elementary equations of the world. Its orientation is merely a contingent aspect that appears when we look at things and neglect the details. In this blurred view, the past of the universe was in a curiously particular state. The notion of the present does not work. In the vast universe, there is nothing that we can reasonably call present. The substratum that determines the duration of time is not an independent entity, different from the others that make up the world. It is an aspect of a dynamic field. It jumps, fluctuates, materializes only by interacting, and is not to be found beneath a minimum scale. So, after all this, what is left of time? You got to deep six your wristwatch. You got to try and understand. The time it seems to capture is just the movement of its hands. That's the Grateful Dead, by the way, not Horace. Let's enter the world without time. Part 2. The World Without Time. Chapter 6. The world is made of events, not things. Oh, gentlemen, the time of life is short, and if we live, we live to tread on kings. Shakespeare, Henry IV, Act 5, Scene 2. When Robespierre freed France from monarchy, Europe's ancien regime feared that the end of civilization itself was nigh. When the young seek to liberate themselves from an old order of things, the old are afraid that all will founder. But Europe was able to survive perfectly well, even without the King of France. The world will go on turning, even without King Time. There is, nevertheless, an aspect of time that has survived the demolition inflicted on it by 19th and 20th century physics. Divested of the trappings with which Newtonian theory had draped it and to which we had become so accustomed, it now shines out with greater clarity. The world is nothing but change. None of the pieces that time has lost, singularity, direction, independence, the present, continuity, puts into question the fact that the world is a network of events. On the one hand, there was time, with its many determinations. On the other, the simple fact that nothing is, that things happen instead. The absence of the quantity time in the fundamental equations does not imply a world that is frozen and immobile. On the contrary, it implies a world in which change is ubiquitous, without being ordered by Father Time, without innumerable events being necessarily distributed in good order or along the single Newtonian timeline or according to Einstein's elegant geometry. The events of the world do not form an orderly queue like the English. They crowd around chaotically, like Italians. They are events indeed. Change happening. This happening is diffuse, scattered, disorderly, but it is happening. It is not stasis. Clocks that run at different speeds do not mark a single time, but the hands on each clock change in relation to the others. The fundamental equations do not include a time variable, but they do include variables that change in relation to each other. Time, as Aristotle suggested, is the measurement of change. Different variables can be chosen to measure that change, and none of these has all the characteristics of time as we experience it. But this does not alter the fact that the world is in a ceaseless process of change. The entire evolution of science would suggest that the best grammar for thinking about the world is that of change, not of permanence, not of being, but of becoming. We can think of the world as made up of things, of substances, of entities, of something that is, or we can think of it as made up of events, of happenings, of processes, of something that occurs, something that does not last, and that undergoes continual transformation that is not permanent in time. The destruction of the notion of time in fundamental physics is the crumbling of the first of these two perspectives, not of the second. It is the realization of the ubiquity of impermanence, not of stasis in a motionless time. Thinking of the world as a collection of events, of processes, is the way that allows us to better grasp, comprehend, and describe it. It is the only way that is compatible with relativity. The world is not a collection of things. It is a collection of events. The difference between things and events is that things persist in time. Events have a limited duration. A stone is a prototypical thing. We can ask ourselves where it will be tomorrow. Conversely, a kiss is an event. It makes no sense to ask where the kiss will be tomorrow. The world is made up of networks of kisses, not of stones. The basic units in terms of which we comprehend the world are not located in some specific point in space. They are, if they are at all, in a where, but also in a when. They are spatially, but also temporally, delimited. They are events. On closer inspection, in fact, even the things that are most thing-like are nothing more than long events. The hardest stone, in the light of what we have learned from chemistry, from physics, from mineralogy, from geology, from psychology, is in reality a complex vibration of quantum fields, a momentary interaction of forces, a process that for a brief moment manages to keep its shape, to hold itself in equilibrium before disintegrating again into dust. A brief chapter in the history of interactions between the elements of the planet, a trace of Neolithic humanity, a weapon used by a gang of kids, an example in a book about time, a metaphor for an ontology, a part of a segmentation of the world that depends more on how our bodies are structured to perceive than on the object of perception. And gradually, an intricate knot in that cosmic game of mirrors that constitutes reality. The world is not so much made of stones as of fleeting sounds or of waves moving through the sea. If the world were, however, made of things, what would these things be? The atoms, which we have discovered to be made up in turn of smaller particles, the elementary particles, which, as we have discovered, are nothing other than the ephemeral agitations of a field, the quantum fields, which we have found to be little more than codes of a language with which to speak of interactions and events. We cannot think of the physical world as if it were made of things, of entities. It simply doesn't work. What works instead is thinking about the world as a network of events. Simple events and more complex events that can be disassembled into combinations of simpler ones. A few examples. A war is not a thing. It's a sequence of events. A storm is not a thing. It's a collection of occurrences. A cloud above a mountain is not a thing. It is the condensation of humidity in the air that the wind blows over the mountain. A wave is not a thing. It is a movement of water, and the water that forms it is always different. A family is not a thing. It is a collection of relations, occurrences, feelings, and a human being? Of course, it's not a thing. Like the cloud above the mountain, it's a complex process which food, information, light, words, and so on enter and exit. A knot of knots in a network of social relations, in a network of chemical processes, in a network of emotions exchanged with its own kind. For a long time, we have tried to understand the world in terms of some primary substance. Perhaps physics, more than any other discipline, has pursued this primary substance. But the more we have studied it, the less the world seems comprehensible in terms of something that is. It seems to be a lot more intelligible in terms of relations between events. The words of Anaximander, quoted in the first chapter of this book, invited us to think of the world according to the order of time. If we do not assume a priori that we know what the order of time is, if we do not, that is, presuppose that it is the linear and universal order that we are accustomed to, Anaximander's exhortation remains valid. We understand the world by studying change, not by studying things. Those who have neglected this good advice have paid a heavy price for it. Two of the greats who fell into this error were Plato and Johannes Kepler, both curiously seduced by the same mathematics. In the Timaeus, Plato has the excellent idea of attempting to translate into mathematics the physics insights gained by atomists such as Democritus. But he goes about it the wrong way. He tries to write the mathematics of the shape of atoms rather than the mathematics of their movements. He allows himself to be fascinated by a mathematical theorem which establishes that there are five, and only five, regular polyhedra. The tetrahedron with four faces, the cube with six faces, octahedron with eight, dodecahedron with 12, and icosahedron with 20. And he attempts to advance the audacious hypothesis that these are the actual shapes of the atoms of the five elementary substances that in antiquity were thought to form everything. Earth, water, air, fire, and the quintessence of which the heavens are made. A beautiful idea, but completely mistaken. The error lies in seeking to understand the world in terms of things rather than events. It lies in ignoring change. The physics and astronomy that will work, from Ptolemy to Galileo, from Newton to Schrödinger, will be mathematical descriptions of precisely how things change, not of how they are. They will be about events, not things. The shapes of atoms will be eventually understood only with the solutions to Schrödinger's equations describing how the electrons in atoms move. Events, again, not things. Centuries later, before reaching the momentous results obtained in his maturity, the young Kepler falls into the same error. He asks himself what determines the size of the orbits of planets, and allows himself to be seduced by the same theorem that had bewitched Plato. It's a beautiful one, no doubt about that. Kepler assumes that the regular polyhedra determine the size of the orbits of the planets. If they are placed one inside the other, with spheres between them, the radii of these spheres will be in the same proportion as the radii of the planets. A nice idea, but completely wrong-headed. Once again, it lacks dynamics. When Kepler moves on later in life to tackle the question of how planets move, the gates of the heavens open. We therefore describe the world as it happens, not as it is. Newton's mechanics, Maxwell's equations, quantum mechanics, and so on, tell us how events happen, not how things are. We understand biology by studying how living beings evolve and live. We understand psychology, a little, not much, by studying how we interact with each other, how we think. We understand the world in its becoming, not in its being. Things in themselves are only events that for a while are monotonous, but only before returning to dust, because sooner or later, obviously, everything returns to dust. The absence of time does not mean, therefore, that everything is frozen and unmoving. It means that the incessant happening that wearies the world is not ordered along a timeline, is not measured by a gigantic tick-tocking. It does not even form a four-dimensional geometry. It is a boundless and disorderly network of quantum events. The world is more like Naples than Singapore. If by time we mean nothing more than happening, then everything is time. There is only that which exists in time.